Hi, everybody. My name's Steven. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon.
Hi, Steve.
You know, when I got here, they suggested that I get in the middle of the herd. And for me, it's like I need a village inside of that herd. And, you know, that consists for me, it consists of a couple sponsors, a doctor, a couple doctors, a couple therapists, a number of guys in this room, a number of women in some other places. Because of my own thinking, I don't do it real well. And this gentleman that I've asked to speak tonight is a part of my team. And with great pleasure, I introduce a man who took him a long time to get here from Newport Beach today. I think it was about 2.5 hours. So let's introduce Jerry B. from Newport Beach.
Before I start, I'd like to apologize to Michael, who came in with me. We walked in. He's gonna love this. And I said, you know, I heard this guy that's speaking tonight is a real jerk. That isn't exactly what I said. I said I know him personally, and I'm Jerry, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I'd like to say before I start that if I say anything to offend you, believe me. I'm also trying to expand on the language of the program because a lot of people, I don't know if anyone's new to the program, but there's a couple things that we have to do. We're asked when we first come in that if people are in another 12-step program, they're asked not to mention that in Al-Anon. And a lot of people have trouble with that in the beginning because they say, well, people shouldn't tell me what to do or whatever. But when you're around a while, you'll understand we're pretty threatened. You know, when people come from the other side, you know, when they first come in. But to help you with some of the language, I'll help share some of the words. AA is what you call when your car breaks down and you're a little short. Sober is a slang word that somebody says when they're exceptionally cold, such as, it is sober. Clean is how you feel after a shower. Clean and sober is the way you feel after a cold shower. An inventory is a British soldier in the American Revolution is responsible for new inventions. A sponsor is a man from a royal family who donates to a sperm bank. That's a sponsor. Letting go is what you do when you pass gas. Abstain is a person is a stain on a person's stomach or abdominal region. Obesity is. As in some of these other groups, is a couch in an obstetrician's office. That's an obesity. Shortcoming is premature ejaculation. Denial is used so commonly as a joke, they made a country and western song out of it. It's a larger river in Egypt. The steps are what you do when you walk. The 12 steps are one more than 11, one less than 13. A baby is a stinging insect who lives near the ocean. Serenity is what the servant says when his master will be in a tea time. A higher power is increased engine size, and a newcomer is a person with their first sexual experience. Check, please. I came to this disease that I don't like to call codependency when I was born. My father was a California brown bear. They mate with the females and take off for the hills and let the females raise the cubs. My mother made up for it by being a drunk. And so with two drunks as parents, one gone and the other one wanting to be gone, I was put in a foster home with my twin sister. And I think that of all the things that have happened to me in my life, that's one of the things that I'm the most grateful for. I recently saw a film called Buck, and if you haven't seen this film, please do yourself a favor. I know that the amount and depth of feelings that people have in this room, that when you see this documentary about somebody who is pretty severely abused, it'll really ring your bell. It's a beautiful film. It's about the real horse whisperer. I think that what happens is that when profound things happen to us in our lives, we have an opportunity at some point to become very grateful. And you'll notice in the themes of what I talk about is I have an enormous amount of gratefulness. I don't think God brought me all this way to drop me on my head. And I don't think he brought any of us all this way to drop us on our head. But when we come into this disease in the beginning and when we're first starting to work with it, it's absolutely devastating. I joined my family when the family reunited with a drunken stepfather. And now I had my mother who was a drunk, my stepfather who was a drunk, and the entire family was dysfunctional. I would bring a friend in the house and an uncle would be passed out on the floor and a friend would say, what's wrong with him? And I'd say, he's taking a nap. You know, all the people in my family were always taking naps. I was in bars as a kid. I was used to being around alcohol all the time. And I didn't really understand until I got into Al-Anon that I had the tears choke up and I realized that I'd been doing this for a lifetime, that it had been going on for my entire life. I was completely and totally unable to express any anger. And at an early age, I realized that I was a real nice guy, that I saw things in people that some people didn't see, but I wasn't able to express the truth about what I saw because I was kind of an interpersonal coward. At about 18 or 19, I played an unusual instrument that was in demand at the time in rock and roll bands, and I was recruited in a number of nationally known rock and roll bands. And I was touring on television, a sports arena, Hollywood Bowl. We were playing all over the place. And every time I walked on my college campus, everybody said, I saw you on TV last night. I saw you somewhere. And I felt empty inside. And I didn't understand why. I think I was surrounded by people who had the depth of a parking lot puddle. The people that play in rock and roll bands don't have a lot of depth. Some of them do, but I didn't notice any, and I certainly wasn't one of them. So after a few years of that, I started pursuing the career that I really wanted to do, and I always kind of knew I was going to do this. What I wanted to be originally was a choir director. What I ended up being is a choir director. but the kind of, you know, this is the music, you know, of my life. This has become the passion and the music of my life. I was very, very fortunate. Once again, I happened to hit something at the right time in the right place. I got hired by the county. They hired me as a group counselor, and I just absolutely bloomed at the job. I started getting stronger. I got able to confront, and for the first time at 24, it was pointed out by my wife that I was totally and incapable of getting mad at my mother. Anytime anything would be said about my mother, I would defend her. And I, to this day, I look back on that and I say, I can't even believe how blind I was to the fact that anger is part of our full range of emotion, just like sadness and guilt and sorrow and everything else. But I had this total incapability of being able to feel any anger. I've gotten over it. Spent the rest of my life trying to get over it and trying to go the other way. I came to Al-Anon the age of 33. We started, there was a stag group going on in Orange County that is still going on. I started another one in Laguna Beach, and if any of you have ever heard Lynn W. from that area or some of the other speakers from that area, that group like this one has just grown exponentially. Now, I know we're in a mixed group here tonight, but the movement of the male Al-Anon groups in the Southern California area is an amazing thing to watch. I think that women should run with women and men should run with men. I think we should have sponsorship in our same sex unless we're gay or lesbian, and I think that it's very helpful when we're running with our same sex most of the time. But I also think when we can come together like this, and you know, in the same room, and I look for a day where the programs can both sit in the same room and be completely at peace with each other, like we are in roundups and things like that, and share, you know, our common strength and hope, because I don't think there's a lot of difference between the two. When I first got to Al-Anon, there was another movement going on at the time. The beginnings of the movement of the ACA, the Adult Children of Alcoholics movement, was going. And I had a lot of trouble because when I went to the meetings, people didn't show up and the leader didn't make it and they didn't bring the literature. And I said, well, it's just like being at home. Even though I felt comfortable in the principles of it, and I realized that I fit some of the characteristics that they were talking about, I realized that a lot of things that were being defined by everyone saying we're all the same. if we came out of an alcoholic family, or if we're in an alcoholic marriage, or if we're in an alcoholic situation with somebody else. And I don't think we are the same. I think we're actually vastly different. And I've gone through those transitions in my life. There is what I call a monster co, and then there's a person who is a rescuing co. I don't even like the term codependency. In fact, I'm involved in a national campaign to try to attack the word. I don't think it exists. I don't think anyone can define exactly what it means. I think what we do is we enable. And I think enabling makes sense. We rescue people from the consequences. We don't allow other people to have the dignity to fail. And in the process of doing that, we become entrenched with them. But the idea that that we're an appendage to another disease, you know, a codependent doesn't even have a name of its own. It has to be an appendage to another disease. There's some other something wrong with that term in my eyes. Anyway, yeah. I occasionally get a little sidetracked. You know, I love the film Up. It's my favorite film. You know, there's this little dog that comes up and says, "Hi, I'm a dog. I'd like to be your friend, squirrel." And then he takes it. Okay. So, do you remember squirrel? So I began to work in the field. I was hired, again, a very opportunistic thing happened to me. I just happened to hit the field when people that had my background were being accepted as workers in the field with my particular degree. And I was hired as the first person at St. Joseph's Hospital, a very large unit in Orange County at the time. And I had about 15 counselors on my staff, nuns and priests. Most of them were nuns and priests, and they just cussed like sailors. And what I saw with the people that were the most healthy on the staff is they were going to Al-Anon. They too were going to Al-Anon. They recognized inherently that they may have had a problem, but their other problem was that they were surrounded by people with an alcohol and drug problem, which is pretty maddening, as you all know. Joe Zuska, a guy who has since passed away, used to tell me, the problem is when you get around a bunch of drug addicts and alcoholics, they act like drug addicts and alcoholics. And it's really funny how that works. So the chaos of the unit, the chaos of the interpersonal stuff, was kind of maddening to me, and I lasted about 6 months and I left. I just said, I don't want to do this. This is crazy. This is not healthy for me. And in the interim, what happened is an amazing thing. I ran into a person that I had not seen in about 18 years. She had been my high school sweetheart. And I ran off with another woman because I later learned in Al-Anon that when we're rigorously honest in all our affairs, we don't have affairs. But I had a little trouble with that in the beginning. So I ran off with another woman, and my high school sweetheart was left, you know, wherever she was. 18 years later, I ran into her, and we started seeing one another. We got married, and we've been married ever since. It's now 30 years. We're just about to celebrate our 30th birthday. And something happened in this marriage for me is, for the first time in my life, I married somebody that was normal. I had a broken picker. I kept picking people I needed to fix. I repeatedly went into toxic relationships with people I thought I could rescue or fix, and I couldn't fix it. So I found somebody that was actually, I think, a lot healthier than I was at the time, and we started working on the Brady Bunch. She had two kids. I had two kids. We were going to bring them together and live happily ever after. It didn't quite turn out that way. One of the first things my stepdaughter said to me is, she looked at me and she said, "You're an asshole, and you can't tell me what to do. And you're not my dad." And I said, "I know I'm not your dad, and I'm never going to be your dad, but I am going to tell you what to do." And I did. And we had because we had four teenagers in the house at one time, which is a lot like being bit to death by ducks. Because we had four teenagers at one time, it was absolute total chaos. And the alcoholism on her side, the alcoholism on my side, you know, it ran all the way through my family and all the way through her family, was alive and well. And we had some really, really out of control kids. It was really, really nuts. And I later learned and wrote that the number one reason for breakup in a second marriage is conflicts over kids. So what you have in most families, and I'm also on a campaign to do this, I walk into a family group blind, and I say literally, how many people in here are the good guys and how many people are the bad guys? And half, I don't even define what it is. And half the people in the room will raise their hand on one and the other half on the other and some people on both. And then I define what it is. In every family, there's the people, and this is back to this Monster Co. versus the, you know, the enabling kind of person. There are people that are setting limits and boundaries and are saying about the kids, we don't set limits and boundaries on their kids, on these kids, the world will, and it's going to be a difficult world for them. The other one says they have major problems, they've come from a broken home, they fell on their head when they're two. Everybody falls on their head when they're two. They're top heavy. They have they have major boogies or hemorrhoids. There's something wrong with them, so therefore we have to treat them with kid gloves. They're ADD, you know, whatever. And so don't sell them, and the war is on, and of course the kids are wiggling out in between. And then you get sides of allegiance. So I literally said to the kids who would come to me and say, she's not treating me okay, you know, really, that's too bad, because I'm going to stay with her for the rest of my life, and you are disposable. You know, you get to leave someday, but I want to spend the rest of my life with this lady. I ran into a quote by Robert Louis Stevenson, which is something that I love a lot of the stuff he writes. It says, children that are born of lovers are born orphan. Children that are born of lovers are born orphan. If you have a bond between you, if two people stand side by side, the kids cannot play them off. And in today's world, this is one of the biggest reasons that people are entering Al-Anon, because they have kids that have the problem. And there is Families Anonymous and other support groups from them. There's also other groups out there, I don't know if you're aware of this, there's Paranoids Anonymous, but then we'll give out the location of the meeting. There's Procrastinations Anonymous. We're working on the outline. We haven't quite got it together. We can't find a place, but we're going to meet, but it got canceled. Anyway, there's other support groups, but there's now in Orange County, I don't know what's going on up here in Orange County, Al-Anon is now splitting off so that they have an Al-Anon meeting with parent emphasis. So everyone in the group is a parent. And obviously parent issues are a little different than spouse issues. I mean, it's still the same disease. It you know, but it takes on a difference when we're taking care of somebody because they're a child and they're needing to grow up and they won't grow up and they're, you know, going out, striking out, coming back, you know, needing to be rescued, and we keep doing. Now, in some ways it's the same, and in some ways it's different. So I think those support groups for us are good as we split off to those things. I think it really helps. So another thing happened along the way. I have some compulsions. I tend to be fairly compulsive about things, and they come out in a lot of different ways. One of the ways they come out is that I have a lot of screwdrivers. I think that actually at the end of my life, I would like to have a tombstone that says a man cannot have enough screwdrivers. But my wife is a little compulsive also, and she puts everything in a Ziploc bag. And so I think probably she would cremate me and put a label maker on there and put me on the, but I hope it says a man cannot have enough screwdrivers. I'm thinking about starting Screwdrivers Anonymous, and she therefore would have to go to Screw Anon. So try to work. My wife and I laughing at ourselves, and actually you notice that I'm doing a lot of laughter right from the beginning. You know, there's a lot of things about my life that aren't very funny. And when I start talking about some things, I used to start talking about things in the past, and I couldn't hold the tears back. Now when I talk about something that I'm tearful about, it's usually tears of joy. You know, when I read the poem of Khalil Gibran that says, to know the pain of too much tenderness. You know, that's a beautiful line, to know the pain of too much tenderness. And the thing that Al-Anon says, don't leave before the miracle comes. What happens is that if we stick around long enough, we get to feel the tenderness and we get to see the miracle and we get to have things happen. When I first got into the program, in fact, the driving thing that got me into the program is it wasn't actually a crisis. It wasn't anyone's crisis. I remember exactly where I was and exactly the time of year. And my wife had gone into, was having a problem of some sort. And I was trying to fix her, and she was upset with me because I was trying to fix her. And so I said, and I sat down and I just started laughing, and I said, you know what? This is a ricochet snit and double reverse. And this is the way it goes. She gets upset, and then I try to fix her. And then she gets upset because I'm trying to fix her, and then I'm upset with her because she's upset with me. And so we're both going off on something because I just caught what she had, and she didn't want me to fix her. She just wanted to listen. Now, later, I developed this by going into the evening staff meeting. And this is what we do. We'd walk through a door and lock it. We'd walk through another door and lock it. This is my wife and I. Go through a third door and lock it. And then we climb into a bathtub that was tiled, and we'd just go sit there and talk about the day. And she would say, I need to talk about something. And I'd say, okay, go ahead. And oh no, I'd say, do you want me to say anything or do you want me to just listen? And she usually said, I want you to just listen. And she'd say, and then she'd get all done, she'd say, thank you. And I'm all done. And I learned something that was really, really important for me as a man. Men are always trying to fix women. And I don't want to be sexist here, but you know, we're always coming, let's just get to the bottom line here. Let's get to the solution to get on. And women use a lot more feeling words than men. They use a lot more words in general. And we want to get to the bottom of it and get over it and whatever. And the women are laughing. The guys are saying, yeah. And we just need to listen and shut up. You know, and just listen to what they have to say and just be there for them. And that's what I do today when she needs to vent. In fact, it's funny, as many years have passed, now she's out of her career. She's been retired for many years, and I'm just working like hell. And right in just the middle of a, you know, passionate career where I'm having all kinds of fun. But I get myself into pickles and get frustrated and whatever. I come home to vent sometimes. Once in a while, she'll say, well, let me tell you how it was when I was working. And you know what? I find myself saying, you know what? I don't want to hear it. You know? I just need to blow up. I just need to express it. We need to have people that would just listen to us. And that's one of the great things about Al-Anon, is that you get to come in and say whatever it is that you're upset about. You can say anything in the world. You can rip into somebody or do whatever you want. Everybody claps and says, thank you for sharing. And then they call in the next person. You know, they don't come in necessarily. No one comes in with a solution. One of the things about group therapy is that there's crosstalk, there's, you know, somebody is doing one-to-one counseling in a group setting. It's ridiculous. But in an Al-Anon meeting, you just speak, you're heard, and it's over. Another person speaks, they're heard, they can go completely off the topic and onto something else. It's just perfectly okay. It's one of the greatest mediums in the world because it allows people just to vent. And the other thing is sponsorship. Now, sponsorship is, I think, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen anyone invent. In fact, in Time Magazine in 2000, Bill W. was listed on the front of Time Magazine as one of the 100 most influential people in the last 100 years. And the reason is that this thing started an epidemic, a movement. This movement of 12 steps started, you know, spreading all over the world. And people are able to do this program and keep it pure because there are no leaders, there are only trusted servants. And one of them, squirrel, and one of those servants are the sponsors who unconditionally give to us month after month, year after year, and are always there for us. I have a guy that I wouldn't actually call him my sponsor. I don't call him my sponsor, but he has an uncanny ability to show up and call me when I'm coming off the rails. It is just absolutely amazing. About three years ago, I get a call and they said, you've got to come over here. And I go over into a part of Orange and the SWAT team is there. There's hundreds of police all over the place, helicopters going around the circle. They said, your brother's held up and he's killed a couple people and the SWAT team's going in, and they took him out. And as I walked in, one of the cops said, I know you. And you're so-and-so, and you work in such-and-such a place. I couldn't believe that they knew me. And it happened. He went nuts. He never had any kind of help at all for his side of the disease. And he wasn't a drunk, but he had no problem for his side of the disease. And he just literally went crazy. He just went absolutely crazy and just flipped out and killed some people, and then they took him out. The next day I got up and went to work. A year later, my mom did the same thing, only she committed suicide. She was incredibly selfish, incredibly self-centered, and while she had gotten sober from alcohol at about 65, she continued to use drugs, and she was just a full-on drug addict, prescription drug addict. She just was blasted all the time, and it was an ugly ending. She sent out guilt messages to everybody so that everybody would feel nice and responsible. I had done everything in the world I could do to save her life, repeatedly putting her in a hospital for suicide attempts, putting her in psych hospitals. I mean, it was just a constant, battle to do it. And the next day after she died, I got up and went to work. Now, I knew, like I've known a number of times in my life, because that's one of the great promises of the program. The program says you will intuitively know how to deal with situations that baffle you. You will intuitively know how to deal with situations that baffle you. I got up and I went to work, but I knew that there was going to come a time when I had to deal with this. And what I did is I waited about 6 months, and then I checked myself into a place called OnSite that's near Nashville, Tennessee. It's a place where you go and do the work and then you just leave. You go do the 6-day work, and it's absolutely one of the best things I ever did to myself. As soon as I was leaving, I wish I could go back. I don't really care for places that say, no, you're going to need to stay a lot more, a lot longer. I think really good therapists, really good teachers, really good parents, and really good treatment programs work themselves out of a job. But that's not really how it works out there. People keep trying to get people to come back. They want them to spend more money. Now, this doesn't work that way. This works, we come back, and nobody's making any money. This is all about giving to other people and other people giving to us. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. We have no commercial or outside interests. That's why Al-Anon works. But it doesn't work when people keep you coming back and coming back and coming back. But this place didn't do that, and I worked my butt off. That whole week, I just worked and worked and worked. The thing I really liked about it is everybody was so anonymous that you couldn't tell anybody what you did, and you couldn't tell them, and you had to get rid of your cell phone. So no one knew what I did. I didn't know what anybody else did. And we were just completely anonymous to each other until the last day. And I felt so relieved. I just felt so incredibly relieved. Because, I tell people all the time, my first name isn't Doctor. My first name is Jerry, and I want to be called Jerry. Or you can call me Dr. Asshole, but I don't like to be called Doctor. It actually bugs me. I don't know why, but it bugs me. So the idea that somebody can be completely anonymous, walk into a situation and leave, all of us in here would not have any idea what anybody else does, and we don't have to know any of those things. And that's a really great thing. It's hard for me to separate at this point in my life what I do for a career, because my career and my 12-step program and my life is so intertwined. But one of the great things that I found out recently, and I can't tell you how relieved I felt when I read this, there's an author named Mihai Macechnihai. Now, any of you who are really avid readers will just light up when I tell you this, because you read it. I see somebody going, mm-hmm. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. His name is Mihai Macechnihai. And I don't think anybody that should have a name that looks like an eye chart. That's not really good. But one of the things he did, and he wrote Flow and Finding Flow, and one of the things he did that he wrote about is he said that people that are really, really successful in their life have no bridge between what they do at work and what they do in their passions. And when I realized, when I did that, all of a sudden I had this huge thing lift for me, because if you work really hard in your job, people are going to call you names. They call us workaholics. They say you're a workaholic. Who cares? There's plenty of time to rest after you're dead. We have everything that we do in our lives, if it involves some kind of service to other people, we are the happiest people in the world. About 6 years ago, I went out on a bicycle ride. I was terribly out of shape, and I went out on a bicycle ride, and I found out some guys were going riding along Coast Highway with them, and they said, well, we're going to coffee, and why don't you come with us? And they said, we're training for an MS ride and doing 100, on a day and 40 the next. And I said, I'd like to train for that. So I went and did it, and they didn't. I made it. They didn't make it. They didn't finish. So then I was going on another 100, and I was out one weekend, and I said to some guys in a club, is anybody here training for 100? And they said, yeah, those guys are over there. So I went over there. Well, I ended up with the wrong group. And they weren't training for 100. They were training for a 200 by doing 100. And so I did that, and they said, all you got to do is slow down. You're going too fast. So I slowed down. About 2 months passed, and I went on my first 200. And I was off to the races. I got started riding 200s. I rode them like 5 times a year, 4 or 5 years in a row. I did like 26,000 miles. This is my Forrest Gump phase of my life. Gen A. I'm not a smart man, Gen A, but I know what love is. And I rode, but what I found in the riding is a bunch of things. I found something in the riding that I knew in a lot of places, but I didn't really understand how it tied together until I repeatedly got lost. I'd get lost, and something always would happen that was amazing. And it started to verify something I believed for a long time, that all screw-ups are perfect. Everything that's going wrong in our life is going on for a good reason. Now, there are a lot of people in here who probably can say, and I heard it in the initial shares, that you're a grateful member of Al-Anon. You will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I don't regret anything that has happened to me with all of the people that took care of me growing up, with all the things that happened along the way. I have learned to regret some of the things I've done, but I've straightened those things out. All of those things I managed to straighten out. But every time I get lost, I get excited. And the people, when I come in at 3 or 4 in the morning and I tell them I got lost, they're worried about me and whatever. I said, don't worry about it. I had a great time. You know, I met somebody, and this last time I got lost, I'm off maybe 40 miles off course. We go up this mountain with this other guy, and it turns out the guy, you know, we're going along. Thank you. We're going along talking. Do I look like I need water?
Yeah.
Should I pour it?
Yeah. I'm codependent, remember?
That's very kind. Thank you. The guy was a geneticist. And all day long, I'm talking to him about, you know, genes, you know, the origins of alcoholism, the origins of bipolar, the origins of schizophrenia. We're talking back and forth about this. One of the most amazing days I've ever had in my life. There's nothing in the world I would replace for that. And I got in it a lot, you know, I'm tired and I'm kind of worn out, and I didn't care. It was fun. You know, it was just one of those things that happened. You may have heard this story about the kid that goes into the Christmas on Christmas Day goes into they open the door where the kid has a bunch of toys, and he's in there crying. And the parents said, why are you crying? And he says, just a matter of time and all these toys are going to break. And they open up another room, and it's filled full of horse manure. And the kid's squealing and yelling and having a good time. And they say, what are you doing? And he says, well, with all this poop in here, there's got to be a pony somewhere. The idea that that there's a blessing in what is going on is very, very foreign to us when we first get in the program. When those tears are choking up, when we just say our name, we don't even say anything about, you know, our qualifier. We just say our name and the tears start flowing, and we feel like we can't talk because we just have a lifetime of pain, or so much pain that we've had before we get here, that we just think we can't go on. It's really hard to imagine that somebody can come along and say, there'll come a time in your life when you're going to be grateful that this happened to you. There'll come a time in your life where you may have to set a limit and a boundary with the people around you that are toxic, but you still won't be angry, or you won't be able to forgive the fact that they were in your life. Now, I've done a lot of work on child abuse. I actually went into a treatment program and worked. Not because I was having any kind of problem, but I worked just on my own child abuse. And one of the things that I figured out along the way is that there's a major difference between shame and guilt. I feel guilty because I've made a mistake. I feel shame because I am a mistake. Shame is really about my parents. If I was born without papers, it's really not about me, that's about them. And they had problems, they couldn't overcome the problems, they dealt with those problems their whole life. In the next generation, we try to make it better. And I don't have to really feel all of that pain that they felt. And this next generation's getting better yet. You know, one of the things you may know is that if you've got somebody in your family that's sober, and you've got a spouse that's sober, and you've got a kid coming in behind them, there's a really good chance that that kid's going to get into recovery early. Because you're in recovery, the alcoholic is in recovery, and that kid is more likely to find his or her way into recovery quicker. And that's exactly what happened in my family. My son was a full-blown addict by 18, got sober, and he's been sober ever since. He's now in his 40s. And he's been sober all these years, and I have another two that don't have a problem. I will tell you, and I don't want this to be sad. I mean, I'll just tell you at the end that that this is not sad the way it came out at the end. We had a daughter. My wife and I had a daughter, her daughter, who had some really early problems. I could see really early on. She'd come in the room and the walls would start shaking. You know, she was just a really, really hysterical person about everything. She had a lot of issues. And I came into her life at 13. She was probably a full-blown alcoholic by the time she was 18. She was in and out of multiple rehabs, and at 32 she passed away. And all of us in the family, in retrospect, understood that she wasn't going to make it. We kind of recognized that. At first, we tried to blame the drug dealers. We, at first, may have blamed each other ourselves. We did all of the things that happen when someone loses someone. But what we did when we all look back is we talk about the great moments that we had with her. We talk about the good times. We talk about the classic statements and the sense of humor we had as a family where we could laugh and have a good time. And we don't remember the pain. We remember the joy. And I think when I see families that are in recovery and I look at them staying in recovery, even after they've lost the significant person in their life that they were qualifying to come in the group for, they still stay grateful for whatever happened and grateful that that person was in their life. You know, none of us are going to get out of here alive. You know, we're all going out some way. And some of us are going to go out sooner, some of us are going to go out later. But some of us can't stay on this side. We're not able to do it. And one of the things I understood with the suicides in my family is that some people need to go. They just need to leave. I'm really sorry when they have to take a lot of people with them. I think that's incredibly selfish. But some people just need to go. I think in our lifetime, I'm not saying I endorse this or I condemn it, but I think in our lifetime we're going to see a lot more assisted suicides. That's the good news and bad news. The good news is that doctors make house calls. The bad news is Jack Kevorkian. Well, I guess it wasn't that good. I always clown at the end of a really rough story because it helps pull me out of it. That's how I do it. I really think that laughter is one of the signs that we're recovering. You know, when you get people laughing and you laugh at yourself, I mean, we're a riot. We're really funny as people. We take life way, way too serious, and I think it's a giant cosmic joke. But we don't see the humor in things. And I can be very, very serious. I can be extremely confrontive. I can call somebody on an ethical violation like nobody in the world. I have moral courage to take on things that other people won't take on. But I love to laugh. And I think at myself, at other people, at everybody, because I think everybody is hilarious. When I first got to the program, the best thing I could do is call God, what's his name? That was my higher power. I had felt pretty betrayed by God. My foster parents were Seventh-day Adventists, were extremely fundamental religion. I got into church early, but I didn't really feel like I belonged. And then I just drifted away, as a lot of people do in college. Think it's fashionable to be an atheist or whatever. But slowly and gradually in the program, God started sneaking into my life. And one of the things that I found along the way is that I wasn't really running things. I don't know when it happened. I don't know exactly an event or a time. I didn't get hit by a bolt of lightning. I just realized I had no control. And the whole pursuit of the idea that I don't have control has become one of the great passions of my life. I'm actually, next week I'm going to Cape Cod to speak to 700 medical doctors that are addictionologists, and the topic is powerlessness. And I spent a lot of time talking about powerlessness. I've worked a long time on building, you know, trying to work with families and understanding powerlessness. And I remember sitting in a staff meeting with people that didn't really, some people who didn't understand addiction very well. And one of the directors of a place who was a normal person said, "I really don't understand what powerlessness has to do with addiction." And I thought, I said, "There isn't anything else. That's all there is." That's the first step for the program. That's the first step for Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step for Al-Anon. We are powerless over alcohol, and our life has become unmanageable. And understanding powerlessness, being able to move from that position, the more powerless I am in my life, the more powerful I become, because I don't fight. I don't surrender. When I was coming up here tonight, you know, I thought, well, this tribe is a lot like having a poke in the eye with a sharp stick. I said, I felt a lot of things coming up here. I felt frustrated, but I felt really, really grateful that I don't have to travel very far on those freeways. You know, I work really close to my job, and I don't have to commute very far. And I realize there's people that do this every day. You know, they drive to Riverside out on the 91. I don't know if you guys have ever been on the 91. They don't even have SIG alerts out there. You know, it's just always stop. And there's people that do that every day. They, you know, they spend an hour or 2 hours commuting back and forth. And, you know, God bless them. I mean, that's a rough thing to do. And I was grateful. I felt grateful that, you know, that I didn't have to struggle that way. How much time do we have? 5 minutes? Okay. I'm on a campaign to change a bunch of things. I've always kind of tried to change things kind of quietly and humorously behind the scenes. And each of us, each time we run into an alcoholic, can have what is sometimes been referred to jokingly as the way an Al-Anon has a slip. It's when we have a moment of compassion. Now, if you happen to be a person who is in that group, that other group out there, those people are really hostile. You know, they tend to be really hostile. We tend to suffer a lot. So we say hello this way. In the event that somebody would cross over into both groups, they would say hello this way. And they, the people coming into treatment do this. And they do it with us all the time. You got to help me. I need money. I need treatment. I need whatever. And at the same time, they're resisting. They're not doing it. They're doing their way. They're slipping. They're going back. It's cunning and baffling. It's something that's absolutely maddening. I absolutely cannot predict who will make it and who won't. I have no capacity at all. And I just laugh at people that try. They say, well, a prognosis is whatever. Like, who knows? You know, God offer you an internship. You know, you think you can predict what will happen. I absolutely do not know the way that this is going to come out. All I know is it's going to be a lot of surprises, and I'm probably going to get lost along the way. And in getting lost, I will probably also find my way, and there'll be some kind of a new experience along the way. I've also come to appreciate people who kick and scream. The people who resist the most and say, I'm not done. I want to keep going. I'm not done. Those are people that I actually appreciate. From this side of that disease, I just say, you know what? That is really refreshing to hear somebody telling the truth. The people that say, oh, no, you know, I see the way, and you just got to get me out of jail, you know, I'm going to do this. I was working with this guy one time, and he says, oh, my wife went into Al-Anon. You could just see this guy was really upset. He says, I went to jail. I hit it on a Friday night. And I called my wife and said, could you come and get me? You know, I got a DUI and bail me out. She said, nope, I didn't get you in there. I'm not going to get you out. And about on Tuesday, because he hit it on a 3-day weekend, he called, the judge lets him out. Or he calls her again and says, will you come and get me? And she says, nope, I didn't get you down there. I'm not going to get you back. And he had to walk home about 6 miles because he was too embarrassed to call any of his friends. And he hit 6 months later, this guy is kind of tongue-in-cheek, being really mad at her, but you could tell he really liked it. Now, what happens is, I've noticed that when they really start to make the change, they start kind of grinning when they realize that we're not going to enable them anymore. When my daughter went to juvenile hall one time because she'd gone to a dance, she ended up down at the beach with a beer in her hand and arrested. And they said, you need to come to juvenile hall and pick her up. And I said, nope, I didn't get her in there, and I'm not going to get her out. And they called a couple hours later, and they said, you got to get her out because we think we really should release her. And I said, nope. And then they called back and said, could we release her to the boy's parents? I said, I don't even know who the boy's parents is. I didn't even know she was with a boy. And then they called about 3 in the morning and said, could we talk to your wife? And she said, nope, I didn't get her in there, and I'm not going to get her out. Now, having been a probation officer, I went down the juvenile hall the next day. I knew that she didn't need to be there. But as she was walking out the car, she said, I'm really surprised. I thought I was going to be here for a couple weeks. I'm really surprised you came and got me. And incidentally, she never got another DUI. And I'm not saying I'm responsible for that, but I'll tell you one more story. Probably the most ultimate act of lack of enabling I did was with my 40-year-old daughter. She's always been in kind of in the I'll get my shit together tomorrow club. I don't know how she possibly could have had this because I'm the past president, so you know the apple didn't fall very far from the tree. But anyway, she breaks up from Mr. Wonderful and asks if she can borrow $5,000, and because she can't make the car payment, and she didn't make the car payment. She put all her stuff in storage and lost it, and then moved back here, and none of the people in the family rescued her. There isn't a single person in the family that we gave her furniture. We all shared furniture with her. But one of the things that I'm probably the most uncomfortable with that I can even ever say is that she went on welfare for a short time to get her daughter covered on welfare. And I stayed out of it. I kept loving her and supporting her emotionally, but I never gave her any money. And about 3 years ago, she bought her own car. And she's out of it today. She's happily remarried. She's making it today. And she's now graduating from college as a teacher. And it's taken her till almost 50 to do it, but I'm really proud of her. Thanks for letting me share.